here. You have to cover a lot of territory with your bill. I know members are around, but if I don't start, Senator, they don't come. So we just have to get going, and hopefully they will come on time to move your bill.
Madam Chair, you
Senator,
have...
Senator, welcome to our committee. You have Senate File 12888.
If we could take that one first, Madam Chair, that'd be great. File 1288 repeals a 1909 law that requires county boards to appoint a road overseer for each unorganized township and pay them $4 a day for their services. Today with me is Lauren Solberg, who many of you know is our former colleague from the other body. I'm not even supposed to say that. All right. To give a brief presentation and help answer any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, Lauren Solberg representing Itasca County. This is a simple bill that probably should have been in the unsession from last year as well. It goes back to 2009 and changed in 1909 and changed again in 1945, updated in 95. And Itasca County has a gentleman who wants them to enforce the law. There's not very many counties that have unorganized townships, and I think if we just get rid of the law, we'll solve several problems. I appreciate your support.
Thank you.
I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Let's put on the record that we now have quorum. Members, do you have any questions for the testifier or for Senator Saxok?
Madam Chair, I'll move
Senator
FL 1288 be what?
Recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I apologize.
Senator Hall?
I was late, but in reviewing this earlier, I had no idea what this was. And could you give me the short of it, Senator Saxog?
It's pretty short.
Senator Saxog, I'm going to make an exception today because I know members have to run. But members, I just want to remind you, we got about 25 bills introduced from different committees that have parts in their bills that have jurisdiction in this committee. So I am going to start on time. And, Senator Ress was not here, so I moved it with Senator Saxog. Senator Saxog, if you could please give us a little bit of information on your bill again.
Madam Chair, I thought I had a pretty good sentence that kind of described it. This replaces or repeals a bill, a 1909 law that requires that county boards appoint a road overseer for each unorganized township and then pays them $4 a day for their services.
Sounds like a good bill. Thank you.
That's all I needed.
Thank you, Senator. So, Senator Johnson renews her motion. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Passes. Thank you. Senator Saxog, you have, I think Senator Rest is here. So, well, let's...
Oh, yeah, because this goes, Madam Chair, this goes
this
a little
go a
longer,
long time.
So if Senator Rest has a shorter bill, she should probably come on.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Senator. Senator Rest, you have Senate File 839, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you, and I appreciate for being late. I'm in three committees at the same time. Or actually, I'm not, which is what the problem is.
And I believe you have an amendment, if I am not.
Yes, ma'am. It is the A2 amendment.
A2 amendment.
This is the first committee.
Senator Johnson moves the A2 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 839 as amended sets up a category of salon under the cosmetology statutes, a mobile salon that can go from location to location. The bill was brought to me by a constituent who provides these services at homeless shelters, shelters for low-income women or facilities dealing with low-income women, domestic abuse facilities, and is my constituent here? I will give her testimony if she's not. She has been involved in this for a number of years, and what she's had to do is get all her equipment together and go in to the facility, and then when she has provided her services, haircuts, whatever, then she gathers it all up again and takes it out. What this would do would be to allow her to have the beneficiaries of her services to come out to the mobile facility and get the service that she would be providing for them, and that's essentially what it is. And the we worked with the Board of Cosmetology, presented the idea to them several months ago in December, I believe it was, or November, and they have been supportive in working with us on the bill. We addressed the concerns of local governments to make sure that the rulemaking authority that is in this bill doesn't change any definitions except to allow a mobile salon. Everything else stays the same. But with the rulemaking authority given to them by, to the board with regard to this, we specifically are sensitive to any concern of local government about where the facility, where the mobile salon would be set up, and that the local governments would, that the rules must specify that the local governments would have jurisdiction over the time and place and operation of a mobile salon within its jurisdiction, which we assume will include not allowing them to pull up in front of an in-place salon and offer their services. So we believe that we have, here she is, we believe that we have addressed the concerns of all the affected parties, and with the A2 amendment, that did you act on that or did I?
We did.
You did, okay.
I think we did. Senator Johnson moved the A2 amendment.
Sorry.
Yes.
We did, okay.
Yes.
That you would act favorably on this bill, and I don't believe that it has another stop if you approve it. And my testifier is now present.
Senator Rest, you will have to go to finance because of the rulemaking cost on this issue.
Okay. That's fine.
And you have a testifier, and I believe that there are also members of the cosmetology board available in case members have a question.
If there are any further questions.
Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon. My name is Charlene Samara. I'm a native Minnesotan, and I have been doing hair since I was 3 on my front porch. Yes, that's right. I stood on the step stool and cut everybody's hair, and since 1982 I've been a cosmetologist licensed and continue in this industry in every aspect. My passion and dream is to bring cosmetology services in a mobile salon setting to domestic abuse shelters, CD treatment centers, group therapy centers, homeless shelters, and other locations serving individuals facing transitional stages in their lives. My vision is to have individuals from these sites be able to step into a mobile salon unit to be pampered and come out not only looking great, but feeling hopeful about their future. They talk about their plans to improve other aspects of their lives and possibilities for their future. The salon is then able to drive off to the next shelter or treatment center to provide services. I am currently volunteering at Resources Incorporated, which provides employment services and training, mental health and chemical health services at over 20 locations. Without a mobile salon, it is very difficult to assemble my workspace each time that I move to a location. I have to load up tools and supplies, unload everything, set up the work area, and then pack it all up. I then drag it back out of the location, pack it all up into my vehicle, and drive to the next location to start all over. And when done for the day, unload it and put it all away again. I am dedicated to bringing personal appearance enhancement services by licensed cosmetologists to individuals in transition facilities to transform their self-image and lift their spirits and self-esteem, which is influential in impacting their potential to succeed and make real changes in their life. I hope to be able to help further their ability to recovery and maximize their capabilities to achieve a brighter future of their lives. In closing, if this bill is passed, I will be able to reach more people more efficiently with the mobile salon. Thank you.
So Madam Chair, we stand ready for questions or comments.
Senator, I think we have other testifiers who wish to be heard, and I believe they are in the audience, so I would like to give them a chance to approach the table. Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gina Stouse, and I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. As Senator Ress indicated, this bill was brought to the board, and in general, the board is in support of the mobile salon legislation. The A2 amendment I had not seen, and I have, without really diving into it, just some concerns about the repeated violations of municipal laws and how our state board would understand the municipal laws and understanding when we would hold them accountable or when we would not hold them accountable. But again, this just got brought to I just saw it within the last couple minutes, so I do have some concerns about the legalities and how that would all get processed. But in general, the mobile salon concept we're in support of. Our biggest concern is the fiscal impact of regulating and writing the rules, and I know that would go on to the next committee to address that. I did want to state for the committee to understand that the regulation of cosmetology does not begin until compensation has been exchanged, so meaning you're paying for a service. So in the comments of going to facilities, drug treatment facilities, et cetera, that's great. However, if just to be clear, if the law passes, it would be anybody could start a mobile salon for any reason at any location, not just to serve individuals in treatment facilities. That it's not limited to that. So I just wanted to make sure that the committee understood that as well.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, we understand that, but the impetus for it came from my constituent and the services that she provides at these special centers.
Well, thank you, Senator. Okay, members, do you have questions? Senator Peterson, Senator Scalzi, and Senator Hall have questions. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ress, could you point me to the area of statute where this is explicitly illegal currently? In other words, I see you're amending 155A23.
Madam Chair,
Senator Ress.
And Senator Peterson, just like a lot of legislation, this is not a this is an addition to the law to specifically grant permission for them rather than repealing something that had been previously prohibited, and that's not an uncommon approach to expanding laws.
Senator Peterson.
So But I mean, I would argue that where the law is silent, you're sort of free to act, you know, in exchange voluntarily with other people in society. So what the bill actually does is place definitions and restrictions around an activity, not necessarily granting permission.
Senator Rice.
Because there's no permission to engage with other people that's needed.
Understanding it, too. We were concerned that there, within the rulemaking, that that these mobile salons not infringe on, I'll call them salons in place. And so it was a concern for us to have a specific language with regard to the rulemaking that the municipalities, we acknowledge that they might want to make those restrictions. And I had three choices with regard to an amendment that that reflected the League of Cities' concerns with provisions, and I actually chose the most restrictive. We might go back and revisit that, but that's the one I chose at this time.
Madam Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Senator Rest. Well, I think for the members of the committee and just for the sake of the hearing, it's important to point out, because as this bill was being discussed in your introduction, it was being framed as if we were somehow allowing something that is not currently allowed, when in fact what we're doing here is regulating otherwise free activity in a manner that previously was unregulated.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, point well taken.
Okay.
Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my concern is that from the Board of Cosmetology and the Executive Director's comments that this might possibly harm existing salons who have real property and are paying taxes. If it were not limited, there really is no limits in here. So a part of the requirements is that they notify the board of the locations, but that doesn't say that the board has any power to negate the activity in a particular location. So I'm sort of likening it to food trucks that would park in front of a restaurant. And there's been some problems with that. So I'm
Chair and Senator Scalzi, I think that's why we have the municipalities' authority through ordinance or whatever. I think they probably have ordinances with regard to the operation of salons or types of businesses in their communities already, and we specifically are asking them to specifically asking within the rulemaking authority that the that municipal ordinances will govern where and times of operation. I mean, I can imagine that they would say it can't be 24/7, or maybe they say it can't be on Sundays. We've heard about all Sunday stuff. And so that the municipal municipalities specifically are asked to exert some ordinance rules with regard to the operation of these mobile salons.
Senator Scalzi.
And I guess my concern is that it's a very important work that you're doing for people in homeless shelters and domestic abuse shelters. And maybe that should be somehow stated in here to alleviate the concerns of the Board of Cosmetology. Have you thought of that, putting it in the law that this is why you're doing it?
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I don't think, although that was the motivation for this bill, I would be reluctant to say that it can only be used by folks that are providing services at homeless shelters or domestic abuse centers. And I don't know that the board would, in their consideration of the bill or the proposal at that time, differentiated that. And we do have people from the League of Cities here that if members have questions about how they go about imposing ordinances on businesses within their communities, including, I would think, food trucks, which was brought up.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rest, is the present law, now that these mobile units are state inspected?
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair and Senator Hall, I don't believe that there are any mobile salons. What we have is someone like my constituent having her stuff, putting it in a car, getting it out of the car, going into the center at their invitation, setting up the equipment, and providing the services to the residents or clients or whoever they may be. Once she's finished, she packs everything out and puts it back in her car. The people that would be providing the services have to be licensed cosmetologists, and so they're not. It's just not anybody can go out and set up this mobile business.
I believe that we have other people who wish to testify in the audience. Do we have anybody else who wish to testify?
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Salon and Spa Professional Association. I'll be very brief in my comments. In general, our association is understanding and recognize the need of mobile salons in certain situations. My comments were only going to be directed to the need to be careful that they don't pull up in front of licensed brick-and-mortar establishments, and we've already had this discussion, and certainly the author has made remarks that suggest that, for the record, that should be included, perhaps at the rulemaking stage. I would also like to just state that perhaps, even though I don't represent the barber industry, that perhaps that same consideration should be extended to barber shops as well. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, that would happen in the rulemaking authority.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Any other comments? Senator Howell,
thank
Senator
you,
Peterson.
Madam Chair. So my follow-up question, my daughter, who's a hairstylist, they get inspected periodically. I guess I don't know how often. But in all of this, they can already do this. Why would they want the government involved with it?
It's my understanding that would be extraordinary to have it without being regulated, to have these mobile salons. But I'll let my constituents speak again to that issue.
Yes, one of the reasons, Madam Chair and committee, one of the reasons that I do want it brought into the Board of Cosmetology is to have this regulated, because normally in order to have a salon open, it has to go by floor plans that they have set, and then they have to inspect it and approve it. So at this point, they have not approved any mobile salons. And this just regulates it so that if I am working in a salon and if I have maybe three different mobile salons out going to these people at women's shelters and such, that I am confident that they are licensed cosmetologists and not somebody that would just cut off your ear and mess your hair up or volunteering and doesn't know what they're doing, or that the instrument and the setting itself is sanitary and regulated.
So. And Madam Chair, going back again to Senator Peterson's initial point, which I think I really did misrepresent the case, mobile salons are not expressly prohibited. However, in the rules dealing with salons in general, there are no provisions for salons to be mobile. And so this is adding a section, in a sense, in the rulemaking for the purpose of salons being mobile. And we would, I think, it's reasonable to assume that regulations and rules for mobile salons are going to have some differences from salons that are in place.
Senator Peterson and Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say again, Senator Ress, I think you've clarified it well. There is nothing, you know, for the committee as well, there is nothing in the law, Subdivision 9, under 155A23, a salon, in its definition, there's nothing in that definition that says that that couldn't also be a mobile unit. And so the regulators could already regulate and could already create rules around mobile salons if they felt like there was an interest in doing so. And I guess I don't understand what the compelling public interest is here. What's the compelling public interest in doing this approach in this bill and in the impetus, I guess, behind 839 in general?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I think it is an expressed interest, first of all, in defining in statute that there is such a thing, subclass of salons, a mobile salon, and then expressly directing the Department of, or the Board of Cosmetology to adopt rules with some of the following caveats, and in particular, again, the concerns of local governments. And, you know, I don't know what more to tell you than that, but that is a solution to a challenge regarding the operation of mobile salons, which currently are not operated.
Senator Hall, and then Senator Hayden.
No,
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Ress, for bringing this bill forward. And I know that I think Hurst had talked about it with barbershops as well. I know that the barbershop that I go to is a barbershop and a salon, and there my barber tells me a lot about his training and how much work that he has to do and different infections and things that could happen if your utensils aren't cleaned and if you're not sweeping your floor and just a lot of things that I just never knew that my barber. I certainly do a lot. So I think that, to Senator Peterson, that to ensure that we are able, that if the profession is going to have more mobile units, we would want to make sure that those units can be inspected and that no matter if they're across the street from the Capitol or in front of a homeless shelter, we should want high-quality salons. And this, to me, would help. The other thing that I know is that the inspectors today know where the shops are. So they go there periodically once a year or once every other year, whatever the case may be. In this case, I think it does help to know how many folks are registered and that they can then meet them at a certain place or at their home or wherever they're going to be to ensure that they're inspected. Now, today, I don't know how the Board of Cosmetology would know kind of where they are and where they would find them if we didn't kind of do what Senator Rest Bill, I think, is trying to do, which is to make sure that we keep up with the times and get these folks registered and to ensure that they're giving out service that is clean and sanitary and at a high quality. So thank you, Senator Rest, for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you. Senator, I'm going to take the last comment from Senator Hall. I think we're ready to vote on this. We kind of understand what the concept is. There's going to be a rulemaking process that will be open to the public and extensive. So, Senator Hall.
This would be to the Board of Cosmetology, if she could take a seat again. I'm just wondering, are there problems right now that we need to write another bill for? We need another law for?
Ms. Stelz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Senator Rest had pointed it out. If the law, if mobile salons were of an interest to put in the board's rulemaking, I think there potentially could be concerns from the administrative law judge that because it's not expressly in the statute that we would not have the authority to write rules for a mobile salon. We have, I do think that there could be a big concern that if it wasn't expressly granted, because I'm sure when the law was written, I think the board's been around since like 1927, that mobile salons were not a part of the initial legislative intent. So I think that's the concern on the rulemaking. There's a few, answer your question, there's a few other avenues in which people, you know, provide services. So to say, you know, is there a concern people can provide services under what we call a special event permit, which is in statute, which is going to non-licensed locations like a hotel room and perform very limited services like if you might want to call it the wedding hair or the prom hair. So those can be provided in a special event permit, as well as we have a homebound service permit that is in our rules that you can provide services to homebound individuals with a certificate of identification. I don't know if that answered your question.
I'm hearing no problems now, but there are some regulations that allow them to do it already now. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I need someone to move the bill on behalf of Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 839.
Okay. Senator Hayden moves that Senate file. Sorry, I had a different order here. 839 be recommended to pass.
As amended.
As amended, and we refer to finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now, Senator Saxel, we are ready for you. Senator, welcome back to our committee. You have Senate File 888, and I believe that you have a technical amendment that you wish to introduce, put the bill in the form that you need.
Just a brief explanation of that, Madam Chair. And thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 888 is the Governor's recommendations to the State Departments and the Veterans Budget Division. And I just want to say I appreciate you taking time to hear the policy provisions with regard to the Governor's recommendations. I have the A2 amendment that I would like to have offered.
Members, do you have a copy of the A2 amendment in front of you? Okay. Senator Eaton moves the A2 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Senator, and I understand that you are going to explain the bill section by section, and you're going to have testifiers coming to talk about that particular section. So what we're going to do is just go through the whole bill and hear your testifiers, and then we are going to open for questions after that.
That's right, Madam Chair. I like to go over the five jurisdictions and the policy changes and the Governor's recommendations as to those changes. So if it pleases the Chair, at this time I'd like to bring Kirk Gadalka, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, to discuss the Revisor's Office Rulemaking System Proposal.
Welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Gadalka. I'm Assistant Commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And I'm here on behalf of the agencies today for, as the author mentioned, a provision in the governor's budget that would create at the revisor an official rulemaking record, electronic record, so that as we move forward, the historical documents used for rulemaking are kept in an easy and transparent manner for the public. Just real quickly, the amendment takes that language, and there are some small policy changes. And the two biggest pieces that the amendment does is, one, allows the agencies to meet its requirement to keep the official rulemaking record into the future through the use of the revisor system. The second change is there are a couple of items that are currently required in the rulemaking record. It is reordered and has them to be just kept for 7 years instead of into the rest of the future because of the amount of material that's collected there and the work is contained in the record and the need for it to be in electronic format that's easily kept.
Thank you. Any questions for the commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner. Senator, we also need, senators, we need to let you know that Mr. Lundin has joined us. In case you have any questions about each part of the bill, he will be ready to help us. So thank you for joining our committee. Senator, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next, in the second jurisdiction, I'd like to call up Matt Mossman, Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Administration, and Dorothy Lovejoy from Materials Management Division at the Minnesota Department of Administration. And they're going to discuss a number of policy provisions related to the to administration.
Commissioner, welcome.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair and members, Matt Mossman, Commissioner of Administration. I'm just going to touch briefly on sections 35 through 37 of the bill, are provisions that relate to the governor's chief recommendations for the Department of Administration around making improvements in the state's targeted group preference programs for veterans, minority and women-owned businesses, and other targeted group businesses. Section 35 is simply a one of the key pieces, really, that most all of these sections apply to in one way or another, is that we want to streamline the certification program so that the criteria for the state program aligns with the criteria for the federal DBE program. So section 35 just simply is aligning for the size of the businesses in all of the 480 or so different industry segments so that we can use the size standards established by the Code of Federal Regulations instead of having a separate set of size standards identified by state. Section 36, then, of the bill, Madam Chair and members, is an aspirational goal. You may know that the preference programs in state law only apply to spending by state agencies when we do state procurement, but if we grant it out, such as capital investment dollars, to non-state entities, the law doesn't apply. And so this would give the opportunity to encourage the use of targeted group businesses when state money is granted out to other entities. And then, Madam Chair and members, Section 37 of the bill is a request for some expedited rulemaking authority. Again, as I explained, this is in lieu of otherwise our approach would be to add potentially 20 or 30 pages to statute in order to bring all of the federal criteria into state statute. Right now, all of the criteria for the state targeted group program is in rules, and so we just want to adjust those rules and do so quickly to align with the federal DBE rules. And those rules are familiar to most businesses because they do already exist in the Code of Federal Regulations. For any businesses that are pursuing a federal certification for minority and women-owned business status. And so this is a more efficient process and allows us to bring those rules into place more quickly and then change them more easily over time if the federal law does change in that regard. Madam Chair and members, those are the proposals.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Mossman, the size standards for what's the definition of the size standards?
Sure.
I know you said it's in federal law, but I don't know what that is.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, all of these preference programs are for small businesses. So there's a size limit that's established under federal law by the Small Business Administration for each of about 480 different industry codes, and so to define what is small versus not small. And so an example, a couple examples might be in the commercial building construction trades. Currently the size limit under state law is $14.5 million. That's the maximum size of the business's worth, and then under the SBA it would be a higher amount of $32.4 million. So some of these are bigger, some of them are smaller. In commercial printing, for example, The size standard at the state level right now is $6 million. It would go up to $32 million under the federal law. But for hardware stores, for example, are a much smaller business, $3.2 million under the state law, and it would go up to about $7.5 million under the federal regulation. So what this would do is those are already standards that that companies doing business in Minnesota under the federal DBE program are already actually being evaluated based on those criteria for federal programs, and we would just use the same standard for state programs.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Mossman, if we go with this here, then the only way we can change this is go to the federal government once it's been put in place.
Commissioner Mossman.
Madam Chair and Senator, we would... No, that is actually not true. I'm just thinking through that quickly. We could actually still decide, the Minnesota legislature could still decide to depart in some way if we wanted to, if we didn't like the direction that the federal regulations were going, say 5-10 years from now. We could revisit the issue, obviously, and make changes to our rules or to our statutes at that time.
Commissioner, I am quite puzzled by this. So if the standards for the federal government have a higher threshold in terms of amount, are we creating a higher... So it, as you know, we have very limited number of business in this category for there are women-owned and owned by minorities. So by increasing the number, and I understand that the regulations at the federal level are even tougher. Could you expand on that? What is the benefit? Is there a benefit to this?
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. The benefit absolutely is that right now we have small businesses who are trying to learn and pay attention to two different set of criteria and evaluate their participation in either the state or federal program. And all of that is directed towards, all of that I think gets in the way of meeting the broader outcome, which is to just have more minority women and veteran-owned businesses that are registered. The more businesses that are registered and participating in the state program, the better positioned the state is in order to encourage those companies to compete for state procurement opportunities, and the more likely it is that minority and women-owned businesses will actually win those procurements. We actually did, Madam Chair and members, do an analysis. Just because we wanted to be clear about how this change, for example, would affect businesses that are currently in the program, and so we looked at all of them because some of the standards will go down for some of the industry codes while others will go up. If the size standard goes up, obviously all of the currently registered businesses will continue to be eligible based on that criteria, and that's true for about 83%, 85% of the industry codes. For the remaining ones, we actually look at the individual businesses where the size standard would go down, and all of the Minnesota-based businesses would continue to be eligible. So at this point in time, we don't anticipate any change based on this change in standard for any of the currently registered businesses, but it will position us to try and encourage more businesses into the program. Mm.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mossman, if you have a veteran minority woman-owned business, is there criteria that will meet that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator, I'm going to ask Dorothy Lovejoy to come up just to make sure that I get it correct, but I believe that there is, it depends on how we do our disparities study as to which one we would, what category we would look at that, evaluate that business on first. But at some point, they would, I think, have an opportunity to become eligible under any of the criteria.
Okay. Ms. Lovejoy, welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and
thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dorothy Lovejoy with the Administration Department Materials Management Division. And I can confirm what Commissioner Mossman said. It will always depend on how we do our disparity studies, how we are classifying the business owners.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I don't understand. You're going to go to the federal guidelines, and that's going to be your base. And yet you have to yet we as a state or every other state that would go along with something like that has to come up with a disparity study to do that? Why doesn't the federal government do that?
Madam Chair and Senator, maybe I can help clarify. For veterans, we do not do a disparity study for veterans. So a veteran-owned business could participate under, if they're a Minnesota-based business, and once we establish a state-based veterans preference program, a veteran-owned business would absolutely be able to seek and participate through a veterans preference certification. Disparity studies are required for race-based and gender-based preference programs, regardless of where they are, in order to those programs can only be legally in state law if there is a demonstrated disparity over time that the state is trying to correct for, which is the case in our state procurement. That's what past disparity studies have shown. So the disparity study applies more specifically to women and minority-owned business preference program.
Thank you. That was helpful. Any other questions? Thank you. Senator Saxon, if you could continue, please.
Next, we have Mike McKelney, Legislative Director, Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, and he's going to discuss the MDVA policy provision found in the last section of the bill relating to support our troops account.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Mike McKelney, Legislative Director for Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And if you turn to Section 4 of Senate File 888, one of the change items recommended by the governor is to...
That's Article 2, members.
I'm sorry. Article 2, Section 4.
20. Excuse me. Proceed.
And what this does is this would this allows us grant making authority essentially beyond what we currently have for the Support Our Troops Fund. As a quick reminder, the Support Our Troops Fund is $30 paid for the Support Our Troops license plates that goes to the Department of Transportation that's split between Military Affairs and Veterans Affairs. And then what it goes up, it's 190.19 is the statute that governs this. And what this would do is a couple of things. It would put us in line with Section 1 of the bill or of the statute, along kind of aligning us with Military Affairs a little bit more. They have broader authority with their portion of the funds, and we would like to broaden our authority as well. Secondly, we get a lot of feedback that the funds that are donated to this program are not being seen out in the community. And so what we've seen over time, just slightly, is a downward tick in the purchasing of these license plates. So we would like to turn the curve, if you will, to bring those funds back into the agency so that we can provide services for veterans. And as we go through the actual bill, Madam Chair, you can see that it would authorize us the authority to provide grants up to $100,000 for various purposes. It would also authorize us to provide grants to eligible foundations. And that's essentially what the bill does, or this section does.
Thank you. Members, any questions? Thank you very much. Senator?
Next, I have Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. And he's going to talk a little bit about the licensing changes in the bill.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Tom DePasquale from the Minnesota Racing Commission. I'm here to address sections 38 and 39 of 888.
That's Article 1, members. H 15. Please proceed.
These provisions are aimed at addressing, at least in part, shortfalls in the Commission's operating budget. Chapter 240 requires the Commission to impose fees on racing and card playing that are sufficient to recover the operating costs of the Commission with the approval of the legislature. And as part of our biennial budget, we're required to propose changes to our fees that will be sufficient to recover those operating costs. We derive our operating revenue from basically two types of licensees, Class C occupational licensees. There are about 30 classes of those. These are everything from employees to all the people on the backside to vendors, concessionaires, et cetera. We issued over 5,500 of those licenses last year for a revenue of $192,000. The remainder of our revenue comes from the two tracks, and you'll see in Section 39 that each of the tracks is required to pay us a $253,000 per year license fee and additional fees depending on their number of live racing days and simulcast days. What the Commission is proposing as part of this change is to extend the duration of certain of those occupational licenses, all of which at the present time expire on December 31st of each year, to a maximum of up to 3 years for certain classifications that we'll describe by rule. And secondly, to lift the license fee cap that has existed in statute since, I believe, the early 1990s. And I'll address the need for each of those changes. With respect to the duration, most jurisdictions nowadays allow for multi-year licensing, particularly for racehorse owners. Commonly, you'll see three-year licenses. So the benefit of extending the license duration to more than 1 year is that it's been requested by our customers. It'll alleviate the crush of applicants that come into our racing offices the first week of racing and in late December. We often have hundreds and hundreds of people in our offices on opening day of the racetracks, and that doesn't allow us sufficient time to do the proper background checks that we're required to do by law. Multi-year licenses will help reduce administrative costs for the commission, and this is also designed in part to increase cash flows in the first year of the biennium so that we can better match our revenues to our operational needs. The second change is to lift the cap to the license fees of $100. Right now, there's an inequity in our license fee structure. Bally's Gaming, United Tote, which is the tote system for Canterbury and a subsidiary of Churchill Downs, pays the same amount as the Nut Lady of Canterbury. Most jurisdictions require gaming vendors and paramutual vendors to pay in the order of $1,500, $5,000, even as high as $15,000 for their licenses. And this reflects the cost of extensive background checks of these parties, more costs of regulating them, and it reflects the importance of these parties to maintaining the integrity of pari-mutuel wagering and card playing. The fact that these companies have come in and for $100 they're allowed to do business in Minnesota, in our view, is not representative of the cost of regulating them or the importance of them to the integrity of our operations. So we intend to establish by rule fee increases for all of the classifications. I should say that of those 30 classes of occupational licenses right now, only four are $100. The rest of them are all under 50. Many of them are $5 or $10 or $15. So the proposed fee increases that we will promulgate a rule is to have slight fee increases for most of those licensees and a larger fee increase on the order of $1,500 for the 5 to 10 pari-mutuel and gaming vendors for Running Aces and Canterbury. In total, these fee increases will net about $100,000 in annual revenue and bring us closer to matching our operating budget of $1.1 million. The last thing I'll say is that with respect to the license fees, the statute does require us to get legislative approval for those fees, so we're going to have to promulgate a rule. It'll go through notice and comment. It'll be approved by the governor's office and the Office of Administrative Hearings, and it'll come back to this body for legislative approval under 16A. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to have Tom Barrett, Executive Director of the Minnesota Gambling Control Board, come up and discuss policy related to a regulatory fee increase.
Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett, Executive Director of the Gambling Control Board. and I'm here to represent my agency, the Gambling Control Board that regulates charitable gaming in Minnesota, just by way of brief background. Charitable gambling currently is being conducted over 2,700 locations in Minnesota by 1,200 licensed charitable nonprofits. And I think one of the issues is a lot of the folks don't realize how big charitable gaming is. It's the biggest in the country in terms of sales and activity, with just over $1.2 billion in gross receipts, making that the largest in the country. But at the same time, in Minnesota, one of the smallest when it comes to regulation. For every dollar wagered, less than 3/10 of one penny is going to my agency in the form of regulation. Our agency is 100% funded from dedicated. There's no general fund funds. Those come by way of vendor fees and license fees to the charities. The last time we adjusted a license fee was back in 2004, nearly 11 years ago. Now, what we're proposing today under Section 40 of the bill, it's a 0.005% in other words, 0.0005 of 1% of total gross sales. Now, while that sounds small, anytime you mess with a fraction and increase it, it has a significant impact. I think you've heard from some of the charities that they're looking at a 50% increase. So if you're listening to me, it's a 0.005% or the charities. But regardless, the board does take into account where the money and where the fees come from. But truth be told, and not included or detailed in the budget, is we've already gone before the committee with a proposed reduction of over $700,000 in appropriations to simply get us to the level that we're currently staffed at. On average, we're getting out to audit the charitable organizations once every roughly 2 years, just a little over 2 years. Love to have it every year, but staffing doesn't allow for that. We've gone from a high of 42 positions to our current level of 32. But this is an industry, with all due respect to the charities, but it's an industry that really cannot be self-regulated. It's $1 billion, it's all cash, and there's a lot of activity. We are supported in terms of our activity by the charities, but I think anytime they look at a fee increase where it takes away from the bottom line, that's their concern. But the highlight I wanted to leave is the last 4 years we have seen an increase in sales activity with the charities. Currently, this fiscal year, it's up another 9%. Now, if that was to continue through the end of the fiscal year, we're talking over $108 million additional dollars in gross receipts. Or if you look at the net, what they take to the bank, the charities are projected to take nearly $20 million to the bank. So in terms of the activity, things are good for charitable gaming. In terms of regulation, we're simply trying to maintain where we're at. And with that, I stand for questions.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Barrett. So, according to your records, the charities aren't really seeing an impact from the lottery sales that have been online for the last couple of years, available online?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, fair question. I think to the extent that, you know, what potential could be in light of, I think, where lottery was looking at some of the play at the pump, and those. I think this was the first year the lottery had an actual decrease in sales. So we're kind of looking to see what caused their drop. I think you would hear from them. They didn't have enough for the big Powerball sales, high Powerball sales to generate. Or in charitable gaming, it's just the frequency of the games and freshness of the games. But tied with the economy, the reduced gas prices, those things are what drive charitable gaming. But to draw a correlation to there are competition as our tribal entities and the other gaming interests, our counterparts at the horse track. But I think in terms of the local support for the charities, what's been happening, I think we're contributing the increases to the improved economy and lower gas prices.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
I think it'd be interesting to know people who are gamblers, if they gamble everything. You know, if they go to the casinos, if they do charitable, if they buy lottery tickets, if they go to the racetrack, or if people kind of pick their preference. The people who go to the racetrack are people who go to the racetrack because they enjoy horse racing. Or the people that go to the casinos, they enjoy the atmosphere at the casinos and having fun there. Or they're the people who just casually, you know, when they're at the bar, they do the charitable gambling. I mean, I'm just interested in knowing, because a lot of times people think these things, these forms of gambling are in competition, and I don't really know that anybody's ever really proven that either way, if they're in competition or if they're totally different worlds of people, different constituencies.
Thank you,
Senator. Random thoughts.
good.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a concern about this 50% increase in the fee. My understanding is that of the gross wagers, 5/6 of that has to go out in prizes. And I asked a friend for some, for like an example of what the issues are. And basically, he says as a 501c3, they can use their profits directly for exempt purposes with educational programs serving school children and public all across southern Minnesota. But federal tax law requires we spend those profits by the end of the filing year or they become taxable. December was a very good month for gambling revenues, but we had to pay all of our bills and spend down our balance by the end of the year. And then, out of new and by no means certain revenues, by the 20th of January, we had to cover our state and local tax bills, which came to 35% of an exceptional past month due to the graduated combined receipts tax. And this 50% increase in fees is going to take a big chunk out of that. And I think that the last place we want to take it from is the people doing this work in as a nonprofit. So,
Mr. Barrett, do you have any?
Madam Chair, I certainly understand what you're saying. I'm not sure if there's a question to respond to. I think you brought up a number of issues, the taxes and the rates. Again, I won't speak on behalf of the tax structure of that. That might be the Department of Revenue. But as I mentioned, the board is certainly mindful of any fee adjustment and how that affects the charity's bottom line. But as I try to point out at the same time, there is significant activity going on in charitable gaming this year in the last 3 years, to the extent that the money they'll take to the bank, if all things remain consistent as they were tracking right now, it's another $20 million. So it's a healthy, I think, activity in terms of in that respect. But I certainly understand going from the 0.1% to a 0.15% and the impact that has.
Any other comments, members? Any other questions? Senator, I have a question.
Yes, Madam Chair.
In page 9, section 19, 20, 21, 22, as you know, we are have been working extensively on trying to figure out how to update the legislation that governs the councils of color. Many people in this committee have been engaged in this conversation. It has been a very productive conversation with the community. Some issues that were brought to our attention by the legislative auditor included the governor's process of appointment and how this appointment process of the board has not been as effective as it could be in terms of how the governor manages that. Yet there is no language associated with this particular provision in terms of correcting some of those issues. And I am quite disappointed and puzzled by that, because I do believe that this was a great opportunity for the governor to provide with some recommendations that we could use in here to enhance the conversations that we're having here at the legislature. So I wonder if you have somebody from the administration who can talk to us about the work that they have been doing with the councils to address some of those questions.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I don't. And I think what we're dealing with, what you're talking about, is significant, but it's dealing with policy, and we probably should be dealing with that in this committee. But that's not what I'm before you. I'm before you with just policy questions and the policy changes that affect the finance part of the bill.
Senator Spencer, I think the question for me is whether or not we do an appropriation without looking into figuring out what to do with the policies. It's kind of it goes together. So for me, trying to figure out when do we do an appropriation versus when do we work on the language. We are working, Senator Pappas and I are working on the language, trying to figure out what would be the best approach and others in this committee. So I would like to ask for your commitment to help us. Of course, we have to go to your committee from here. But, and of course, you know that we have been working extensively to figure out this language process. But I wanted to hear from you in terms of your commitment to work with us as we move forward, since this particular recommendation is moving forward in this particular bill.
Madam Chair, I'm looking forward to yours and Senator Pappas' recommendations.
Thank you.
In my
Thank
committee.
You. Thank you, Senator. Senator Anderson and Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Saxog, does this include the 1.8% increase for the numbers that are in the bill?
Senator Saxog.
That the governor recommended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, this is just those policy changes that need to come before this committee, and we want to have your recommendations and your approval. It doesn't really have anything to do with any finance decisions. The 1.8 is in the finance committee, as you're aware.
Senator Anderson, Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Saxog, does this include appropriations for the debt service on the new Senate office building?
Senator Saxog.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, the bill coming out of the Finance Committee will have that item that you just referred to.
Senator
Will that also have the additional $379,000 that the governor requested for his office? Will that be something different then, or is that included here?
No. Madam Chair, Senator Hall, these are policy recommendations.
Thank you, Senators. Yes, it's, I think Senator Saxog is correct. We are only reviewing some of the policy recommendations here. I wanted to ask a couple of questions on these issues just because we're working on extensive policy, but all other issues will be discussed in his committee. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's a policy issue to increase the fees on charitable gambling, and I'd like to propose an amendment on line 15.26 to delete 0.15 and replace the language that was crossed out, the 0.1%.
Senator, could you please tell us again where you are?
15.26, page 15, line 26. After of, basically undelete 0.1 and delete 0.15.
I think we have Mr. Barrett.
Restoring the original language.
Yeah. Restoring the original.
Madam Chair, I'll ask Mr. Barrett to address that.
Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator, I understand. I think what the amended would do is reduce any kind of fee increase, and that would force us to go back to then cut staff or some of the expenses that we've had. So if that's the intent, then I would certainly encourage, if I can come back with proposed changes, because there's some things within what we do and how we regulate charitable gaming that could add as a cost-saving measure not only to the board but to the charities as well. And one of the examples I'm talking about is the education requirement.
But again, Madam Chair and Senator Eaton, we're talking about policy here. We aren't talking about finance.
This is policy, though.
I have been advised by the staff that this is a relevant amendment for policy, Senator. And I understand that Mr. Lund is here, who wishes to say something.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alan Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota.
The fee increase is of great concern to charities. The actual fee increase that the Gambling Control Board wanted was a doubling of the fee from 0.001 to 0.002. The governor pared that back to a 0.0015. We pay our fee based on sales, not the money that we actually get to take to the bank. So the last 4 or 5 years, they've had 5, 6, 7% increases. This year, it sounds like a 9% increase, according to Director Barrett, that is coming from our bottom line. In at My American Legion, if this passed the way it was today, our fee goes from $2,800 to $4,200, which means we no longer get to fund 3 scholarships. So our point to the Gambling Control Board has been, work with us. We understand what you're saying. If you could work with us to come up with a solution that is equitable, it would be very much appreciated. So we are opposed to the policy change. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Lund, did you say that this was already a compromise with the governor's office?
So the Madam Chair, the Gambling Control Board had initially asked to go from a 0.001 to a 0.002 of the governor. When he took it out of the Gambling Control Board bill and put it into his bill, he reduced that from the 0.002 to a 0.0015, which we certainly appreciated, but we didn't believe went far enough.
Okay, members. Senator Eaton has an amendment before the committee. Do you? Okay, so, Senator, your amendment will delete Section 40 because that's the only provision for Section 40. Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lund. So is there any fee increase that you, your organization or your association would be willing to accept? It sounds like there was some negotiating there, but and you said, I think you said you'd be willing to work with them. I mean, what is there a number? Do you just not think it should be increased, or do you think that there's a number that would satisfy your association?
Mr. Long.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, so as an example, there were no increases given to the manufacturers and the distributors that do business in Minnesota. And when I questioned the director about that, he said that his belief was that those costs would have been passed on directly to the charities. And my point back was that they didn't have that opportunity to take the increase on their own. In fact, I talked to a manufacturer representative and said, let's both open up our books, and who can most afford it will pay the increase. They were reluctant to do that.
I'd like to try to restate what was said before, is that the fees that go to the board are a percentage of the gross wages. It's not what they have left after they put out the prizes. It's so the board got a 9% increase, while the so did the charitable gambling, but they only got an increase in 1/6 of what they took in. And so that they're so what I'm saying is, doubling that fee is really a hardship on the nonprofits.
Any other questions, members?
Not really doubling it.
Senator Dahl.
Madam Chair, Senator Sachs-Hogg, how do you feel about the amendment?
Senator Sachs-Hogg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, I'm not sure we're going to respecting what the senator is going to do with this amendment, whether it passes or not, we have to deal with it again in finance, too. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'm just concerned that, as Mr. Barrett mentioned, there's a lot of money involved here, and there's a lot of potential for problems if people aren't trained, if we don't have a strong regulatory system. And we want to make sure that we keep it as straightforward and as clean as possible, and only being able to audit every 2 years is not really very much. So, and given the fact that it hasn't increased for, did you say over a decade, or since 08, or for a long time, 04, it seems to me this is a reasonable request. So I would urge members to vote no on the amendment.
Senator Eaton.
Well, I encourage members to support this amendment because they have had a 9% increase. As the director said, they've had a charitable gambling has increased, so there has been an increase to the board, and whether they need to do some restructuring or whatever, but raising the fees by 50%, I think, is pretty huge chunk to take out of the nonprofits who are trying to do scholarships and funds like that.
Okay, members, I think we're going to have to vote on this. So all of those in favor of Senator Eaton's motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion is not adopted.
Division.
Division has been called.
Just a division hands. Show of hands.
Let's do a show of hands. That's good. All of those in favor of the motion, please raise your hands.
Just talk louder.
Okay. So I think the motion is not adopted.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Saxon.
Finally, I'd like to ask counsel to explain the carry-forward language found in Section 34 of the bill.
Madam Chair and members,
Ms. James.
Under current law, agencies are allowed to carry forward unexpended and unencumbered non-grant operating balances from the first year of a biennium to the second year of the biennium. This change, and then at the end of the second year, any unexpended amounts canceled to the general fund. This change allows them to carry it from any year to the next year, so it would allow them to carry forward from one biennium to the next.
Page 13.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's on page 13, beginning on line 12.
Madam Chair, this is an answer to use it or you lose it.
Right. Members, do you have any questions about that provision? Okay. If not, I need somebody to make a motion on behalf of Senator Saxon.
Madam Chair,
I have an amendment.
Excuse me, Senator Pappas.
I was just going to hope that and ask that this bill be recommended to pass as amended and referred to the Finance Committee.
Correct. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I almost forgot. I have the A1 amendment.
Senator Pappas has the A1 amendment.
Madam Chair, I can explain it while it's being passed out. It's simple.
Could you please?
The Legislative Coordinating Commission asked me to offer this amendment. It extends the sunset date for the Mississippi River Parkway Commission by 4 years, from 2016 to 2020. Our representative on the Parkway Commission board is Senator Senjum, and he supports this change. I actually had the privilege of serving for a few years on the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. It's not a very well-known commission, but certainly the work that it does in advocating for the parkway and making sure there are signs up and advocating for various projects along the Mississippi River is very important. And they work a lot they get some grant money, and they get a lot of help from Department of Transportation, Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you, Senator. I also serve, I believe, still in the commission.
Oh, you're in the commission,
too. I know we've reviewed the appointments, but...
Madam Chair, I support the amendment.
Members, do you have any questions about the motion? If not, all of those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted. Any other questions, members? Any other comments? If not, Senator Wicklin moves that Senate File 888 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to Finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. I believe we have Senator Sharon in the room. She's been waiting. Senator Champion is also in the room. Who do we have? Senator Sharon, are you okay with time? I know you've been waiting. testifiers. We have, I think Senator Champion has a lot of testifiers too. I think Senator Champion is next in the agenda, Senator, if that's okay. The staff is telling me that Senator Sherrance is going to move really fast. Senator Champion, would you be willing to? I understand you have more testifiers than you probably thought you would. Senator Sherrance, do you have testifiers?
Just to answer your questions, if you have any.
Okay, we don't have. Okay, so if we could go quickly and then move to Senator Champion.
I would defer to Senator Champion if there's an issue. I just have to be out here by 4, so.
Senator Sherrance, you have Senate File 857.
Got 3 minutes.
Thank you. I have an amendment, the A1 amendment.
To Senate File 857. A4 members.
Tell us, Sherrance.
We have it in our packet, I think.
No, we don't.
Oh, no, we don't.
Uh-oh.
Okay. It's coming.
Thank you. I can just describe a little bit because of time. This amendment really has been recommendations from the legal staff for this committee to put the bill's language in the form that the committee likes to approach, clarifying duties, clarifying a section about the working group. It's mostly clarifications and describing more clearly what the Commissioner of Public Safety is permitted to do. And it changes terms around the definitions of who will be a part of the membership group.
Madam Chair, I'll move the amendment.
Members, do you have any questions? If not, all of those in favor of the A4 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Wade Setter from the BCA is here with me. I'd have him come forward in case there are any questions for the committee. We can save time if he would come forward now. This bill would establish a working group that's convened by the Department of Public Safety, the Commissioner of Public Safety, to study the state's needs for a Silver Alert program to aid in the recovery of missing persons who are senior citizens with dementia, traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's disease, or other disabilities. Wandering, as you know, is a serious concern for individuals living with any form of dementia, and we know that about 6 out of 10 people with Alzheimer's will wander at some point during their disease process. So with the growing population of seniors and increasing rate of Alzheimer's, we think that it's right to consider the possibility of implementing this Silver Alert, which is already implemented in 35 other states. So at the end, we'll form the working group, and at the end, the working group concludes that there is a need for the Silver. The group will make recommendations, and those recommendations will include the criteria for the system itself, and the bill defines the membership of that working group. It describes when the first working group will convene, when the report is due, and with that, I think it's pretty straightforward working group to try to determine need and then determine the system that would be used, the criteria for the system if we implement a Silver Alert. And that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Senator. Do we have any questions for Senator? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sherrance, yeah, it seems to me this is a need, and it could have just been put into law. Do we really need a working group to set this up? Is it that complicated, or, you know, it just seems like a really good idea.
Senator Sherrance.
Well, if you want to just make a motion to implement this immediately, you know, I'm not going to object to that. But I think I would ask Mr. Setter to respond to that.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Wade Setter. I'm the superintendent of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And to answer your question, Senator Hall, as you know, in one of the other committees, the Judiciary, we discussed the Blue Alert system. And it's really a terms of impact on the system. That's what we're trying to understand. With the Blue Alert system, which is a peace officer's seriously injured or killed, and we expect no more than 1 or 2, God forbid, during the course of the year. This has a potential broader impact, so we feel it's appropriate to study it in order to determine if we're able to implement it without any fiscal impact.
It's fine.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, Senator Hall?
I'd like to move it.
Moves that Senate File 857 be recommended to pass as amended and be sent to the floor. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator. Senator Champion. We have Senate File 223. Welcome to our committee. Thank you for giving Senator Shan your turn.
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present this bill before this committee. This is my first time in front of this committee, and I must say that I'm excited to be here. Madam Chair, Senate File 223, I have a delete all amendment. I think that's important because when I first introduced this bill, after talking to a constituent of mine, it is something that we maintain is really an exciting hybrid and possibility. But there's some things there that the Board of Cosmetology and others wanted to, you know, look at in real time, but also provide them the authorization by which to consider the proposal that's before it and go through its rulemaking process. So I would like to speak to that delete all amendment in real time first. It is the A15-0146. I think you all have it before you. Do you have it, Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Champion. And this is an author's amendment, so if members would like to move it on his behalf.
So moved.
Okay, Senator Johnson, Senator Hayden move the A15 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you. As I mentioned, Madam Chair, Senate File 223 has this delete amendment was developed as a result of discussions with the Board of Cosmetology, my constituent, and others. And the delete amendment authorizes the board to establish an apprenticeship program with appropriate supervision. You will see that in subdivision one as well. You will also see that in subdivision two, the delete all also allows the board to adopt fees and a penalty structure that covers the board's cost. And you'll see that, as I mentioned, in subdivision two. Subdivision three articulates important program components. The board and I and all of us thought it would be important to sort of lay out some things that they would look at and components that we believe to be important for consideration, like the eligibility requirements, the application process, what is necessary for an apprentice to complete the program, supervision and theoretical instruction, which includes monetary issues. The board must also develop a theoretical curriculum and who must administer the curriculum, because there was some discussion about this hybrid because it allows instructors to also be embedded in a salon. Therefore, we wanted to make sure that the instructors had a curriculum, it was approved, it would lead any apprentice towards licensure. All that would be important. And so we also make sure that another requirement was for a registered apprentice performing clinical services in a licensed salon to be paid wages commensurate with their experience. That's one of the things that we believe is very important, as we want people to be engaged and find a way to receive the instruction that they need in order to be good apprentice, but also for there to be a wage if possible. And then also you'll see that the board may adopt rules necessary to establish the apprenticeship program. And finally, you will see in the effective date that the effective date would be July 1st, 2017, and the whole reason for that is because it gives the board an opportunity to go through the rulemaking process, get input from the public, from a variety of different sources, and use all of that information to come up with what we believe to be a very thorough and informative and productive hybrid. The one thing that I will say, and I would hope this committee would also take into consideration, we had some pushback from individuals who says, well, if you come up with this hybrid, then it will put my school out of business. Well, I believe that the guiding principle should be whether we create an opportunity for all individuals who might want to participate in this industry to have an opportunity to do so and for them to have options and choices. That's what's important, right? We want to make sure that every student still get the instruction that they need, get the opportunity that they need, but also give the public what they need, which is safety and regulation and real consideration. So with that being said, Madam Chair, I would ask this august body to pass this bill. Now, we do have someone here from the Board of Cosmetology, if this group would like to hear from them, and it's my understanding that they should be neutral on the bill because they did help us come up with this language, and I'm sure that they have the ability to definitely articulate their position as well.
Thank you, Senator. Ms. Staus.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members for allowing me to testify again today. As Senator Champion said, sometimes there's kind of two roles that I play. One is if legislation gets introduced as the executive director to try and make the language work, if, in fact, it does pass. However, I do have a board that are my bosses that I report to, and this did go in front of the full board. Currently, we have six members because we are down one member at the time, and they voted 3-3. So, you know, it's a neutral position. I would say that the educators, we have two educator positions on the board, and they voted, they were a part of voting against this. So that's in their role. But so, you know, that's part of the board's position, you know, and as the executive director, it's really dramatically shifting the way in which students are educated. And we haven't had an opportunity to reach out to the – there's nine other states that do apprenticeship programs to be really do what I would say is our homework in understanding for me to help educate my board better on how these programs work well or don't work well in the nine other states because we were not a part of the drafting of the initial legislation and we're not aware that the legislation was getting introduced until it was dropped into the Senate file. So the you know, our concerns, and I think that's kind of addressed in Section 3 really is, again, is the funding. We don't have staff to be writing the rules to create this program. I feel it's going to take the several years. We're going to have to hold town halls and get input from all the stakeholders that might be in place. It's not that the program isn't possible. It's just that I don't feel I can sit here today and tell you that I've been able to do my research as I would normally do as the executive director. The one state that did respond to us in Alabama, and I think this committee heard something earlier this year about human trafficking, that human trafficking is a component that has been creeping up at higher rates in the cosmetology profession. And the Alabama board had stated that they felt that the apprenticeship program is potentially a cover-up in certain situations of human trafficking. I have no evidence that that would happen here in Minnesota, but I do feel it is important to note. But we're thankful that Senator Champion gave us the opportunity to help write the A15 amendment to be able to better work with the legislation if it does, in fact, pass.
Hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Senator Dahl and then Senator Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Staus, was the 3-3 vote from your board with the amended language or before on the original language?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, it would have been before the delete all because our board meeting was early February. However, I think the vote was on the concept of an apprenticeship, regardless if the board was given the authority to write the rules. I think the vote was split simply because of the three were not interested in even having apprenticeships as a part of the training program, and three were on the other side. So I don't know if it's the contents of the bill, rather the concept of an apprenticeship. Thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Champion,
So is my understanding that the what we have now is a an education of how to get a license or to get certified, and what you're doing is adding an apprenticeship to that possibility, another avenue to get certified.
Madam Chair, to
Senator
Hall.
Champion.
Absolutely, Senator Hall. It really is about how do we create opportunities and provide a student options to really eventually become a licensed person, right? And so when you think in terms of I heard the word shift moved, used, it is because it's sort of like at one time when traditionalists were against online colleges or online things, right? There was a real understanding that if at the end of the day we want to expand the capacity of those who are in the marketplace, we want to find ways by which to do that, but do it in a responsible way. And so here, I think this proposal is a responsible way because what it does, it authorizes the Board of Cosmetology to really look at it. You see that there's a theoretical component around curriculum that's attached to it. There's some supervision issues that they can deal with in real time, as well as other important components that would be necessary in order to make sure that we have the sort of proposal or the sort of framework that students at the end of the day will be able to pass any of the licensure exams and be a thriving person in this industry.
Senator Hall.
Thank you. Okay, so I did want to know there was a final exam. It sounded like that's what you were telling me. And then I also heard that this is a way of bypassing school, although it's a different path. My kids were homeschooled. It's a different path to get educated. It sounds like there's some questions here. Why not just put a working group together for this and study it instead of just beginning this thing, kind of like we were with the last bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall. So let me be clear about something, Senator Hall. Number one, there is a final exam that is involved, is because a person has to, pass the licensure test in order to get a license. So there is a mechanism that will allow a person's capacity to be evaluated. So it's not bypassing anything. Number two, I don't necessarily think a study group is necessary. That's why you have a board. That's why they can go through the process that they need to in order to see and test and determine if this is even possible. And if so, what additional components should be in place in order for it to be thriving and beneficial. So I think that this coming together does provide the Board of Cosmetology, who is in the best position by which to go through its paces in order to make sure that we are giving these students the capacity that they need in order to be thriving cosmetologists.
Senator Hall and then Senator
Wicklund. Ms. Stoss, would you think that it would be best for you to take this on, or would you rather see a working group?
Ms. Stoss.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, my preference would have been to study it before we pass a law to create a rulemaking. I was here a couple weeks ago and we created a new license, and the board spent about 2 years having all the different stakeholders at the table before we came in front of the committee to introduce legislation. But again, that was board driven legislation, and this is not a board initiative. So
Madam Chair, if I might speak to that, because Senator Hall is a well-informed one, this particular board had an opportunity even before this legislation or this proposal came forward to propose to this body a mechanism to study this issue if this is something that they initially wanted to do. Because the whole concept of an apprenticeship program is not new. And so even my good friend who did get a chance to talk to Alabama, now simply because they're in Alabama, I won't question it, but that says something all within itself. Because when we begin to think about human trafficking and other potential challenges that they have put forward, I don't know what that means, but I know that that's not the purpose that we believe that this sort of programming would be helpful around. Let me give you some suggestions. Someone who's coming out of prison or some other place someone who's hard to employ, someone who says, hey, this is an area where I want to be in, and it's a hybrid. Not only am I covering theory, but we're also looking at the practical aspect of things. What about an individual who's going into their second career and they decide that, hey, cosmetology is something that they want to explore, that they want to consider? This, again, allows them to not only get the instruction that is necessary, but also be in a real-time salon getting some real-time experience, because theoretically and practically practicing are two different things, because you get a chance to see the dynamics of different people who come into a salon and what their needs are and how demanding they might be, and you might decide at the end of the day, perhaps this is not what I want to do. And so I think this hybrid creates that opportunity.
Thank you, Senator. We have Senator Wicklund, Senator Hayden, Senator Johnson, and Senator Johnson. Members, we have two more bills after this. We have until 4. So we've lost members already because they went to the next committee, but we'll have to come back tonight. Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question about on line 1.23 where it says the board must develop a theoretical instruction curriculum. My question to Ms. Staus, does your board get involved in creating curriculum on a regular basis? Is that part of your general duties? And then second part of that would be, do you have funding to accommodate the time that or to pay for development of a course like that?
Ms. Staus.
Madam Chair, Senator Wicklund, line 1.23, the board has in its rules kind of a global common curriculum aspects, but we don't get into the nitty-gritty of, like, if you're going to teach dermatology, all the different elements, or if you're going to teach chemical relaxing, all the different elements. So as a part of the appropriation in line, starting in section 3 on line 2.5 in my fiscal note, we would need to likely employ an instructor or someone with expert knowledge in the field of cosmetology. I'm not a license holder, and most of my staff are not license holders, so we would need someone in-house to run this program. So we do not have the funding currently to support another staff, an FTE, to administer this program, so no.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Champion. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I do think that it should be in the purview of the board to be able to do this work. And I, quite frankly, and I'm sorry, I lost your name in my testifier, Ms. Staus.
Yep.
Ms. Staus, that I'm not quite sure why it would take you so long. I mean, the resource issue aside of getting the proper person in your office, I'm not sure why it would take 2 years to go through all of these stakeholders to be able to move that forward. It seems to me that we'd be able to expedite that through technology and the ability for us to be able to bring people together just to hear what they have to say. So I do think that we could expedite that. Secondly, I would caution you, before you start to say what other states have been doing to really do that work. So if you've only talked to Alabama one time and there's other states that are doing it, I would actually ask for you to really kind of formally talk to them about what their experiences has been relative to what has happened, what are the pros and the cons. But to kind of, I mean, this committee and this legislature and this state is very, very sensitive to the human trafficking issue. And so we work on that. I've had a bill that has established work groups to look at this issue. We've done a lot of work. So just to kind of throw that out without qualification, without understanding how many people were in the sexual trafficking business and the apprenticeship, cosmetology apprenticeship in Alabama, I would want to know that. And I'm not going to take up the committee's time to start to press you for that. But I would caution you that before you started to say even anecdotally what other states have experienced, that you do that in a way that we understand it and you can qualify that comment. So, Senator Champion, I really do think that this is a great idea. And I think that the committee should really consider this. And I do think that the Board of Cosmetology is the right place versus a working group in which to do so.
Senator Johnson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Staus, I am not comfortable with this bill. I do not, as it stands, I do not believe that the apprenticeship program is one that would be one I would want to see. I've done quite a bit of cosmetology bills in the 2 years, 2.5 years now that I've been here and before that. Most of the time they have been bills that have been asking for more oversight and more education to strengthen the status and meet the new needs that we have with working with people in cosmetology. As we get into more and more of the skin and other things, it is really not a profession that I think is one that would be one what I would like to have an apprenticeship working on me. So I would question also about the fiscal note, if there is one, and what that would be. But again, it's the safety and health of the clientele that are coming into those businesses that I would say no to this apprenticeship program. Sorry, Senator Champion, but
no. Madam Chair, and to Senator Johnson, I think your points are well taken, but I think that if you look at what's in the bill, your questions are actually answered. Now, whether you come to the table with a predisposition to say that I don't like apprentices at all, one can respect that. But if your question is whether there's enough education that's going to be there, if you look at lines 1.23 in the bill, it talks about the development of the theoretical instruction curriculum, which is important. And so that gets to the education. Also, if you look at line 1.25, it says the board may collaborate with a licensed cosmetology school to develop this curriculum. So the education component that you have spoke so eloquently about is already covered there. When you think in terms of oversight, if you look at 1.20, it says supervision of an apprentice, including theoretical instruction under paragraph B, by licensed cosmetologists as appropriate, including eligibility requirements, and monitoring of the supervisors under this clause. So each component that you are concerned about is covered in this bill. And so if it was missing, I would agree with you, but it's not missing. It's there. In fact, the board assisted me in putting this portion together in order to make sure that we have every base covered as pertains to supervision, curriculum, and just giving them the authority to even further look at it in order to make sure they, from their perspective, have the wide lens and they're able to look at what's important and necessary. So your concerns, Senator Johnson, are outlined in the bill, and I just laid it out for you. Thank you so very much for your concern.
I'm going to take the last comment from Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. And Senator Champion, I actually do think it's a good idea. I just think that it's not ready for prime time in the sense that, as Senator Hayden and others have said, we need to talk to more people. We need to study what's going on in other places. I think putting a group, a work group together would be the best way of doing it, in that it would make a group come up with best practices. And although you may say it's all in there, the concept to me I like in general, the principle I like in general, but I think there's more time and study needs to be in it, so I will be voting against it.
Hey, members, I think we have, I don't know if there will be additional testimony, but I think we are ready to vote. Senator Champion, if you would like, I think we have the board. I think we have somebody who wants to testify. Please. Mr. Long.
Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, Jim Hurst on behalf of the Salon and Spa Professional Association. I will try to make my comments brief in the interest of time. I would like to acknowledge in the audience is representatives from the Minnesota School of Cosmetology, one of their instructors, as well as a director of the school, as well as a handful of students from the school as well, who are very interested in this. Their concerns mirror my association's concerns, in that while an apprenticeship program in general, perhaps does have merit. We believe that it was more appropriate once an individual has completed their in-school curriculum and to complement their instruction in that manner. It should not be viewed upon as a complete alternative to existing educational requirements. And this is no different than what currently barbers have. Currently, if you pursue a barber license, you go to barber school, and then after completing school as a barber in barber school, you then pursue an apprenticeship program in order to acquire your master barber license. However, we're focused here today, of course, on cosmetology. We have concerns that with the legislation as proposed, there's no guarantee that the theoretical instruction would be completely embraced as what schools of cosmetology do. Schools of cosmetology also have a clinical aspect to their instruction, and that is seen in the salons that are based on the school grounds, where members of the general public come in, they realize that they're being serviced by students of cosmetology and not licensed professionals. I think in the end, what's really clear is that in order to seek licensure as a cosmetologist, you must pass the state exam. And certainly students at a cosmetology school are fully versed in achieving that ultimate goal. And what we would hate to see happen is that individuals who take the apprenticeship route perhaps don't have the enough of the education to pass that test. An apprenticeship program is envisioned to take roughly twice as long as a in-school instruction. Currently, you need 1,550 hours of education to pass out of cosmetology school. The bill, as initially introduced, called for just about twice that amount, or just about 3,200 hours. My fear is, or our fear is, that it would be very unfortunate if, in the middle of this process, perhaps the providing salon that initially offered this instruction were to suddenly then stop doing it. That would leave the individual in limbo, and then there would be the difficulty of trying to find another provider to transfer those credits. You know, the salon in question would have to maintain meticulous records, much like a school has to do, as far as the hours of attendance and doing everything. So it's a lot more involved, shall we say, than to simply just open up an apprenticeship program. And in closing, keep in mind, to be licensed as a cosmetologist, that includes three different disciplines. It's not only just hair, but it's also nails and it's also skin. So, you know, an apprenticeship program would have to make sure that they address that. And certainly we would want any student or in this case an apprentice to be fully versed in all of those three disciplines so that they can pass that ultimate test at the end.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator Hayden has a question, and then Senator Champion can give us his closing remarks.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say, it looks like Senator Champion wanted to get in. It looks like, Senator Champion, that I still think that this is a good idea, and I actually think your bill has addressed all of the concerns relative to setting this up. But with that being said, there does look to be some consternation, so I guess I'd want to get your advice before I make the motion, because it's non-debatable, if we might lay this on the table and continue to work on this session. But I'd ask for your advice first.
So if I might just briefly, Senator Hayden, thank you for the question. And you are right, because when you listen to the testifier, they are creating a standard that even they cannot adhere to, which is a guarantee. So the last time I went to McAllister College and they couldn't guarantee that I was going to complete it or be able to pass whatever test that I needed to. And when you think in terms of salons, having the ability to do this, there is the instruction capacity, and that every person who's coming through would be required to pass the state exam. It does. This legislation involved nails, skin, and hair. So if you had a chance to read that, you would see that. So with that being stated, I'm always of the mindset of what I heard Senator Hall say, to explore whether there's a working group or something else that can be done in order to make sure that we continue to move this ball forward, because we are planning on moving this ball forward, and I think schools should be aware of that we are going to look for opportunities and hybrids that are going to directly compete with them, right? And so with that being said, I would entertain a motion to lay it on the table that allows us to continue to do some work and bring it back to this committee.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make that motion.
Senator Hayden made the motion to lay Senate File 223 on the table. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion has passed. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Lurie. We have Senate File 1172.
Madam Chair and members, I have Senate File 1172. This is the first time 1172 has been heard. I do have an author's amendment. The A2 amendment, I think, is included in members' package to bring it into shape. If I could have that moved, I would greatly appreciate it.
The A2 amendment is in your packet, members.
I have an oral.
So token. Senator Scalzi moves the A2 amendment. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say no. Amendment is adopted. And you have an oral amendment to the amendment, Senator, or did you say?
Council, do we need to actually move that on line 1.4? It says delete everything after all, but it should say delete everything before all. Meaning we can just incorporate that.
Okay, so we adopted the amendment, so we don't need to do that. Thank you, Senator.
Good.
Please proceed.
So what this 1172 is the sections of the governor's health and human services budget bill that pertain to state and local government. So this is the last stop for these items. They've been signed. The policy's been signed off on in HHS already and in Judiciary, and then just earlier today in Commerce as well. So we're here to look at the state and local implications of five sections from that bill, and any amendments made here today would then be incorporated into the larger bill. We split up a couple of sections to travel separately because dragging that whole beast through all of the policy divisions becomes unmanageable. So we split off a couple of bills to do this, and again, any amendments that we made, if members wanted to track it, would then just be incorporated as we went into the larger budget bill. So again, five sections. Section one of this bill establishes the Minnesota Radon Licensing Act in the Department of Health. Subdivision one permits this section to be cited as the Minnesota Radon Licensing Act. Subdivision two is the definitions. Subdivision three authorizes the Commissioner of Health to adopt rules related to the licensure and enforcement of the laws, and that's what brings it here is the rulemaking authority. Subdivision four of section one requires all radon mitigation systems installed in Minnesota on or after July 1st of 2016 to have a radon mitigation system tag provided by the commissioner. Subdivision five requires that every person or firm corporation that sells or performs a service for compensation to detect the presence of radon in the indoor atmosphere, performs laboratory analysis, or performs a service to mitigate radon in the indoor atmosphere be licensed on an annual basis, and specifies that it does not apply to retail stores that only sell or distribute radon sampling devices. Subdivision 6 specifies that radon systems installed in newly constructed homes are exempt from this section. And Subdivision 7 requires that the applications for licensure, system tags, and other reporting requirements be submitted on forms prescribed by the commissioner. Subdivision 8 establishes the fees, and Subdivision 9 states that the commissioner shall enforce this section under Minnesota Statutes 144, 989 to 993. Section 2 and 3 are also in the MDH sections. Section 2 specifies that the authority to adopt rules consistent with the Toxic Substance Control Act do not expire. This is for lead repair and abatement, and these rules are not completed yet, so having the rulemaking authority expire wouldn't work very well. Section 3 is part of the vulnerable adult protection measures in the governor's budget. Section 3 adds a requirement, Subdivision 1 adds a requirement that the supplemental nursing service agencies retain for 5 years all records pertaining to their registration, including those records related to the agency's insurance and bonding and its employees' education, training, and licensing. Subdivision 2 removes the requirement that an agency must engage in a pattern of failure to comply with the provision of the section before it's subject to revocation or non-renewal of its registration, whereas so now a single instance of failure to comply is sufficient to undertake this action. Subdivision 4 then requires a hearing involving an administrative law judge prior to the revocation or rejection of an agency's registration or renewal of registration. So that's the sections on MDH. The Minnesota Department of Human Services has two additional sections. Section 4 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to develop and execute projects to reform the mental health system by participating in the Federal Excellence in Mental Health Demonstration Project. Subdivision 2 of this section requires the Commissioner to submit a proposal to the Department of Health and Human Services at the federal level for this demonstration project. Subdivision 3 gives the commissioner rulemaking authority to establish the standards for reform projects under this. That's this rulemaking authority that brings this section before us here. Subdivision 4 of Section 4 requires the commissioner to establish standards for state certification of certified community behavioral health clinics and specifies what the certification standards must include. The commissioner is also required to establish standards and methodologies for a prospective payment system for Medicaid payments for mental health services delivered in these clinics. And Subdivision 5 requires the commissioner to consult with mental health providers and others in developing the projects under this subdivision. Subdivision 6 requires the commissioner and the state chief information officer to provide information systems support to the projects as necessary to comply with federal requirements and deadlines. And then finally, the last big section is Section 5, which creates the Opioid Prescribing Improvement Program. Subdivision 1 requires the Commissioners of Human Services and the Commissioner of Health to establish a statewide opioid prescribing program to reduce opioid dependency and substance abuse due to the prescribing of opioid analgesics by healthcare providers. Subdivision 2 of this section is the definitions. Subdivision 3 requires the Commissioner of Human Services in consultation with the Commissioner of Health to establish an opioid prescribing work group. That's the piece that brings in the state and local conference and brings us before you here. Subdivision 4 requires to the commissioners the components of the statewide opioid prescribing improvement program. Subdivision 5 has several paragraphs. Paragraph A requires the Commissioner of Human Services to implement the program and annually collect and report the opioid prescribers' data showing the sentinel measures of their opioid prescribing patterns compared to their anonymized peers. Paragraph B of Subdivision 5 requires the commissioner to notify the prescriber and all provider groups with which the prescriber is affiliated when the prescriber's prescribing pattern exceeds the opioid quality improvement standards threshold. Paragraph C specifies that if after 1 year the prescriber's prescribing practices are not consistent with community standards, the commissioner may take certain remedial steps. And paragraph D requires the commissioner to disenroll from the Medicaid program all prescribers and provider groups whose prescribing practices fall within the applicable opioid disenrollment standards. Subdivision 6 of this section classifies that the reports and data identifying an opioid prescriber as private data on individuals until the prescriber is subject to disenrollment as a MA provider, then permits the commissioner to share with all the provider groups with which the prescriber is employed or affiliated or identifying that prescriber. It also specifies that data and reports identifying a provider group are non-public data until the provider group is subject to disenrollment. At that time, the data and the reports are public, except that any identifying information fees must be redacted by the commissioner. Finally, Subdivision 7 of this section requires the commissioner to annually report to the legislature on the status of the implementation of the program, including data on utilization of opioids in the MA and Minnesota Care programs. So those are, Madam Chair and members, the five sections, three from MDH and two from DHS, that are the portions of the governor's Health and Human Services budget bill with implications in the state and local division. Happy to stand for questions.
Senator Loria, I was just asking the staff as to whether or not the provisions in this bill meet the criteria of the committee, and they were explaining to me that some of the deadlines that we typically see in here are not incorporated because of the urgency that has been stated to you by the commissioner. Could you cover that a little bit so that we leave that on the record?
Sure. There's a couple of pieces. That you're talking, I believe, about the opioid prescribing work group and the need to get started on this sooner rather than later. And it's really a work group, not a task force as well. And so if it were the task force, you know, it comes with all the trappings of who chairs and calls the first meeting and by what date and how chair is selected and whatnot. This is a little less formal because of the importance of getting this started, and the commissioners are working well together and moving forward. And so if we can allow them that flexibility to just pull this work group, not the full-fledged formal task force, and comes before you here together and work toward trying to put together these protocols to ensure proper opioid prescribing is followed, and that when it's not followed, somebody's tracking it and able to get behind it and take action, really start to clean up that leads to addiction problems on the streets.
Thank you, Senator. You know, I will argue the opposite, that, you know, when we don't say anything, it gives room for permission to have a lot of discussion, and then it goes on and on, you know, how it goes. So, but obviously the commissioner's perspective may be, she has been working on this and she knows what's going on. But I think it is important that we incorporate some timelines, because when we work with groups, we typically have agreements, disagreements, we want to cover more, and we never end. So I think those deadlines are important. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to thank Senator Lurie for bringing this forward. We lost another young woman yesterday to opioid overdose, and if you don't have anybody from the Policy Committee, I'm available.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions? Senator Lurie. We have a motion. Senator Eaton. So, Senator, you go to the Finance Committee from here. So, Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 1172 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to Finance. All of those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Senator. Chair and members.
Members, we could finish,
yes.
If that's
yes.
Okay. Okay.
So you don't have to come back in game.
No, I'd rather come back.
Senator Wicklund,
because they're supposed to be meeting
hopefully
here.
Hopefully, they move across, so they gave us the room if we want to finish.
Oh,
so they are
yeah,
in the other room. I'm going to go check in so they have a quorum.
Thank you, Senator.
And then I'll come
we
back.
Appreciate that. We're almost done. I think Senator Wicklund is prepared to move us quickly.
Yes.
I will definitely try.
Thank you, Senator. We appreciate that. Senator Wicklund, you have Senate File 1553.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1553 is DHS policy bill.
The bill is actually kind of a subset similar to the bill that Senator Lurie just presented. The base bill is over 170 pages, and to reduce confusion, I've introduced a bill that contains the sections that are under the jurisdiction of state and local government, jobs, and transportation committees. And so bringing this before you today is meant to kind of streamline the process for the DHS, the overall DHS policy bill. So there are seven sections, but there are two that are of primary interest to this committee. I can go through those first, or I can start and just briefly go through each section. Which would you prefer, Madam Chair?
Choose the two sections we need to hear. Choose the two sections that we need to hear, Senator.
Okay. So Section 5 is the first one, and that has to do with the Cultural and Ethnic Communities Leadership Council. And I have Patrick Carter is here to speak to that one. It is a council that was established in 2013, and DHS would like to put it into statute now. It was established in session law, and now they would like to put it into statute. The language is mostly the same, except that they have changed the definition of membership slightly, and also extended the time that the council would be in place. So, and to speak to, I don't know, do you want to speak to those two? Okay. One of the concerns was there is a need to have a representation from the American Indian community, and they were finding that it was difficult to meet the criteria in the original council language, and so they would like to broaden the membership language to just state American Indian participation, and I should find that page. Okay. So 6.12, it states the American Indian community, rather than before it was more specific and more difficult to find members to meet that. And then the council date for existence, they would like to have it expire on June 30th of 2020. The original legislation, the council was going to expire March 15th, 2015. And so they would like to extend it. So those are the only two on that, right? Those are the only two changes. The council has produced two reports thus far, and I can speak to that, or Patrick Carter can speak to that council what they have produced thus far. But they have been working, and this would allow them to continue working. So I don't know if members have any questions about that.
Senator Wicklund, I have to tell you that I am delighted that you're doing this. I happen to know this council quite well. They receive training at the Humphrey Institute to really look at how they can do their work. I'm trying to figure out if this is the same group. I don't know. I don't think you have any other advisory committee, but this was the one Antonia Wilkinson.
From what I understand from DHS, it is the same group that you
thank you.
Are possibly
thank you, Senator. In fact, I was going to introduce some legislation because the council just finished an extensive training that was provided by the Humphrey Institute to really prepare themselves to work with the Department of Human Services on issues of disparities and really provide that technical and capacity and ability to advise. And so it was really disheartening to see that they did all of this work and have been preparing to work with the commissioner, with us, and with the communities, and then the terms expired. And so I really appreciate that this is part of the proposal and that the department is pursuing this to continue their work, because I think they are really prepared to help now. And they have been before, but I just think that they've done tremendous work to really do this well with the department. So thank you for doing this.
Certainly, you're welcome. And it does appear that they are doing good work and will continue to have a key role with the DHS, with the department.
That's great.
So Section 7 is the other section that it relates to this committee, and on page 8, line 32, this has to do with some obsolete rules regarding prior authorizations for medical supplies and equipment. The department no longer uses the process of having, now I'm looking for the words, performance agreements, special performance agreements. They no longer use these. They haven't used them since at least 2007. And so they would like to just repeal this language. And there is the last clause, 9, on page 9, line 12, for the commissioner to use the good cause exemption to adopt rules under this section in order to perform this action.
Members, do you have any questions? I think you have some testifiers that would respond. Senator Hall.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I would just soon hear the testifiers first.
Okay. Have any additional? I think they are here to answer questions, but...
They're mainly here to answer questions if you have a specific question about one of the...
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, is this establishing a new group here, or is this just changing some things?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, it's not establishing a new group. The council exists and was created in 2013 through legislation, but it's in session law, and they would like to codify this council in statute. And so that's why it's brought back forward to us. The membership of the council, one of the types of members is clarified. That was what I was speaking to about the American Indian membership. They made one change to that description, and then they changed the ending date to June 2020.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair. Senator Wicklund, can you tell me what's the difference? This seems redundant to what we have with the Council of Colors. How are they different than the Council of Colors?
Do you want to speak to that more specific? I'll let the testifier.
Thank you, Senator. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, Patrick Carter from the Department of Human Services. And Senator Hall, to your question, The same question was brought up when the council was created 2 years ago, and DHS thought that it was important to have a specific advisory group to the commissioner related to health and human services equity issues. And so there are several members of the Council of Color that are represented on this council, but this is specifically focused on health and human services issues and intended to advise the commissioner about those issues.
Senator Hall.
Madam Chair, that's great, but why aren't we just taking the Council of Colors and have them relate to the department?
This is my understanding, Senator Hall. This particular council is a mix of internal staff as well as representatives of agencies that DHS works with. So it's a very precise, it's a group that does very precise work only on issues that that are under the governance of DHS. And the purpose really is to be able to figure out how DHS is working with these specific communities, because they have an overrepresentation of these communities almost in every area of service. And correct me if I'm more familiar with the child welfare piece, just where you have a tremendous disproportionate representation of children of color who are being removed from their homes and placed, and so they are in foster care. So throughout the child welfare system, they have this significant overrepresentation, but then they have 87 counties and 11 reservations who are responsible for implementing these policies. So it's a very complex and very unique situation where they have these contracts with counties, with nonprofit organizations that provide the service to this population. But, you know, you might expand. That my understanding during the training was that they wanted to really partner the staff as well as the nonprofits. The counties were represented in that. So there was a really a large group of individuals that represented all the stakeholders that really work only on health and human services. That was my
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And is there a fiscal note, or what do we financially cost us?
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, there is no appropriation for this council. They do not receive stipends based on, I think, Chapter 15 is where the stipend language is. So there is no cost associated with this.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? If not, Senator Wicklin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that Senate File 1553 be recommended to pass and be referred to
Committee on Transportation.
Transportation, yes. Thank you.
So all of those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say no.
No.
The motion is adopted. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Sorry, I was just trying to figure out a answer to the question. So, members, this is all for today, and thank you for your patience. I really appreciate that we were able to finish, so we will adjourn for today.